Well, what did they ask you yesterday on Live at 5?
Where do I get my ideas?
All right, let me write that one down. You see, I didn't come in armed with notes.
When somebody asks Stephen King that, he says, Utica. Which he and I did once in the program somewhere. And let's see, was it true that Valediction will be on next Sunday's Times bestseller list? Yes. Not this Sunday, but a week from Sunday, the 20th. Mm. First of my books to make the national list.
Mm.
So now I'm too important to do this, and I'm leaving.
That's right. Well, no, but listen.
I asked the publicity people, does this mean I don't have to go on the tour anymore? And they said, no.
No writer is too important to sell a book. It's one thing to write a book. It's another thing to find a
audience. Part of the job. I think it's part of my responsibility as an author when the publisher and I make agreements on what they'll do and what I'll do. It seems to me not only am I responsible for writing and sending it in, but for promoting it afterwards. That because it's not only my royalties that are involved, it's the salesman's commissions and all of that. And when you make a public appearance, if you are sufficiently celebrated to have an impact, it does things for the wholesaler, the retail sale, or the salesman who can go into the bookstore and say, yes, Parker's on a 31-city author tour, and we have 7 trillion dumps and all of that going on. And I think that's a valuable contribution which I can make. My goal is not to make valuable contributions necessarily, but nonetheless, it seems to me part of the fabric of the relationship between writer and publisher to do this, though God knows it is painful.
Oh, no, I'm sure it is. But there's another thing, too, to think about. You don't write for yourself, and you don't write just to put something in a drawer. I think you want to have an exposure, and you want to reach people, because I think you want people to read your books, don't you?
Yes, I do. Even more than that, I want them to buy my books. I have a kid in college. You know. High up there at Sarah Lawrence, $14,180 next year.
Sarah Lawrence?
Yeah. My son's at Sarah Lawrence. He says it's co-ed now.
Yeah.
He has an awful happy look on his face all the time.
Yeah. That is an expensive one.
Yeah, it is right up there amongst the leaders. But it seems to have been worth it. Sure, I want people to buy it. I think that I would disagree with you slightly in that I want people to buy it and I want people to read it, but I write it for me. While it's being written, I'm not thinking about readers or potential motion picture sales or paperback reprint rights. I am just trying to get this aesthetic artifact in as good shape as I can get it. I'm trying to make it fit. It's a little like carpentry. The studs don't always have to be right 16 on center. But when I used to do carpentry, I always tried to get them 16 on center because I wanted to be right. You know, no one's going to see it. I'm not thinking about, gee, how will this look when I'm done? I'm thinking I want to get this thing to fit square. And once it's out of my typewriter, then the last of those kind of judgments has been made.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes produce. You know, and it becomes a commercial enterprise. And I'm quite happy to do the commercial part of it. I mean, I'm glad it's a commercial enterprise. How unfortunate if it weren't.
So you're going, how many cities did you say?
Oh, I don't know. This time I'm doing about 9. It's better than some tours. Last spring and the previous December to that, I did 15 cities in 15 days, right around the rim of the country. You know, New York, Washington, Dallas, Houston, up the West Coast and stuff. And that will just scramble your brain. This time out, I've come and then I've gone home for a few days and I've gone out again. I was in Cleveland Tuesday. I was in Boston. What's today? Friday. I was in Cleveland Tuesday and Wednesday. I was in Boston Thursday, and then I came down here Thursday night. And I'm here through Sunday, and then I'm going to Philadelphia and Detroit and Chicago and Atlanta. And I'm going home, then I'm going to Toronto, and I'm going home, then I'm going to go to Dallas, and I'm going to go home. And then in July, I'm going to London to do a writer's conference with Stephen King and P.D. James. It's a tough, dirty job, but somebody's got to go over there.
Be put up in Buckingham Palace? Or
well, Hotel Barclay, actually, I think I'll be at. But anyway, that'll be fun.
I want to ask you some questions about yourself and also about how you develop Spencer. But I want to tell you a funny story about touring that Dan Greenberg tells. Knowing Dan Greenberg, do you know Dan Greenberg?
I know who he is, yeah.
He was in Pittsburgh, and he had written a book called What Do Women Want?
Mm-hmm.
And so he was invited to do a talk show there, and it was obvious that the talk show host had never heard, or never had not only heard of Dan Greenberg, but had not read the book or even seen the cover of it.
Not an uncommon experience, I might add.
So he said, well, we have to keep this short, and of course we focus on your feet, rowing a rowboat across the Atlantic. Greenberg said, huh? No. My book is about human relationships. So the talk host was dumbfounded. He said, well, can we talk about rowing across the Atlantic?
But Danberg's Greenberg said, sure, yeah. So they spent 5 minutes on the air talking about rowing across the Atlantic.
Well, that'll work. That's the attitude that you really do need to have if you're going to do this very much. Because you, quite literally, what happens to me sometimes on, say, the 15 cities in 15 days, is I will be on the 9 o'clock television talk show, which every city bigger than Tupelo, Mississippi has, talking to a host. And I'll answer a question, and in my head I'll think, did I just answer this question a minute ago? Am I just saying it over and over again, or did I say this yesterday? And what makes it work, I think the people who are least discomforted by it are the people who recognize that very frequently, particularly in television, you're not going to get a lot of information out. You're going to fill the airspace in a pleasant fashion. And if you accept that, then you'll talk about rowing across the Atlantic or bumblebees or whatever anybody wants to talk about.
Well, let's talk about rowing across the Atlantic.
row.
You said a moment ago that you were a carpenter. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I was born in a trunk in the Princess Theater. I have a B.A., an M.A., and a Ph.D. I have two sons. I've written 14 books.
Are you from New England?
I was brought up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My standard line is I grew up in New Bedford, not everyone does.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Colby College, and then I got my graduate degrees at Boston University over a span of some years.
What was the thrust of your studies?
American literature, specifically the American hero as he was expressed in the novels of Hammett and Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a segue into what I do now.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, the carpentry was a sideline that you
Joan and I built the first house we lived in pretty much. That is, we bought a four-room cape when she was 15 months pregnant with David, it seemed like. We turned it into an eight-room colonial over the years. And I, both for economic reasons and some reward, did almost all the manual labor. Joan did a good deal of it.
Where do you live?
I live in Linfield at the moment, which is just north of Boston.
When did you get out? When were you sprung from Colby?
1954. Mm-hmm. I went in the Army, and I did some work in advertising, tech writing, and public relations. Worked for Raytheon, a Prudential Insurance Company, and eventually, we decided I didn't like that, so I went and got a Ph.D. so I could become a professor, so I'd have time to write. And I became a professor, and I did have time to write.
Well,
so I did.
Are you still teaching?
No, I was sprung from that, free at last, Lord God Almighty, free at last, in 1978.
Where were you teaching?
Northeastern University. I was a tenured full professor there, and I was teaching fiction writing for 3 hours on Wednesdays, and when I decided to leave altogether, Joan said to me, but you're only teaching on Wednesdays. And I said, yeah, but every Wednesday.
Cut into the things you really like to do.
Yes.
How did your first novel come about?
Well, in that way. That is, I had always wished to write and hadn't married early and had children young. And where was women's lib when we really needed it back then? So that I needed to work and didn't have time to write. And over the years, discovered that if I were going to write, I needed long stretches of uninterrupted time. I need, say, 5 hours in order to get out 2.5 hours of writing. That's undisciplined of me, but that's the way it is. And I need look out the window time and check the mail time and talk to the dog time. And the only way I could find to do that was to become a professor. It was Joan's idea originally that I do that. So I quit work when I was 30. I had a house in the suburbs and 2 kids and 2 cars. Joan immediately pitched right in, went back to school, too. So we were all in school, all 4 of us, and nobody was working, and I scrambled a lot. Actually, I was working, but it was one of those years where you have 10 W-2 forms at the end of the year. It took about 9 years to get the degree because I had a lot of other things going at the same time. So I was almost 40 when I finally got to be a professor. But as a professor, I had a teaching load of 9 hours a week, which will leave you long stretches of uninterrupted time. And then I wrote the novel. First novel was the Godwolf manuscript. Still available, friends, in paperback at your local bookseller.
Was that a Spencer?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you launched your writing career with Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
You
had done a couple of textbooks and a book on weightlifting in that Sports Illustrated series that they do prior to the publication of the Godwolf manuscript. But it was the first work of fiction and the first sort of real book as opposed to the other kinds of things. And I finished it and sent it in, and the first publisher I sent it to called me up within 3 weeks and said they wished to publish it. So I have no Garrett stories. On the other hand, I was 42 when the book came out, so I had a long gestation period, as it were.
I noticed that some of the early Spencer editions are collector's items.
Yeah. Right.
I saw one over at the Mysterious Bookstore the other day. It was $150.
Yeah, I saw someone pay $190 for a copy of God Save the Child, which startled me. For a buck, I'd have told them the story, you know. Much cheaper.
Well, you've also written some nonfiction.
Yes. Joan and I did together an autobiographical book called 3 Weeks in Spring, and then I did a novel called Wilderness, a straight, you know, mainstream novel, as they call, which will be soon to be a major motion picture, as the phrase says it. You ever seen a minor motion picture? Soon to be a minor motion picture. And Love and Glory, which came out rather quietly last fall, is a love story of about 30 years duration from 1950 to the present.
Obviously, your interest had been in Dashiell and Chandler. And,
mm-hmm.
You can see that the characters in those novels are the prototype for Spencer. Does he have a first name, incidentally?
He does, but it's never been used in the books. Mm-hmm. In other words, I know what it is if I ever chose to use it, but I never have.
That will be a secret. That
will remain a secret. It didn't start out to be a secret, but everyone's so interested that I figured I may as well keep it.
Oh, yeah,
way.
Yeah.
Spoil things.
Yeah, please don't divulge that. That was obviously a deliberate effort on your part to create a character very much like those in Chandler and Hannah.
Particularly at the beginning, sure. When I started the first novel as a novice, never having written a novel before, I was very conscious of, particularly of Graham and Chandler. And you know, when I had issues to solve, I would think, what would Marlowe have done or how would Chandler have solved this? As time goes on, I have moved a considerable distance, not deliberately, simply because once one begins to write and get published and discover that the next thing you write is also going to get published, there's a kind of relaxation, you know, there's job security, as it were. And at that time, I stopped thinking, what would Chandler do, and I just let it go. And I think I'm quite a different human being than Chandler was, and consequently, as time goes on, I have grown a fair distance away from Marlowe.
And certainly different from Hammett.
Yes.
And your writing style is very spare, very easy to follow. Very direct, without a lot of description. I mean, I don't see that you go into great descriptive passages of the landscape, and they're novels of action, and they're very direct. You carry the reader through your plot very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I also noticed that there's a continuity, for example, in A Savage Place, Rachel Wallace turns up.
Resurfaces, yeah.
Resurfaces, yeah. After her kidnapping. And in Valediction, of course, there are references to
Candy Sloan
was murdered.
Yeah.
And
right.
So I have a feeling that if I were to start at the beginning, and I'm not familiar with the earlier books, but if I had started at the beginning, I would have a whole story.
You would have a whole kind of saga, and in many ways I think of what I'm doing as a episodes in an ongoing story, not unlike Faulkner. I like to lump myself in when I can with Faulkner. I'll allude to Henry James in a while. It seems to me what that produces is a kind of verisimilitude in which things happen to characters the way they happen to us in life because of things that did happen. There's a living history that goes on, and what happens in book A influences what happens in book B, and so forth. That produces good news in that I think it makes a rather large, coherent collection of work. The bad news is I have to be very conscious of the reader who has never read any other books, and at the same time of the reader who's read them all in sequence. And that gets kind of tricky, and the first-time reader needs to know things that the fifth-time reader has known for a long time, and how to get that worked in is sometimes more complicated than it would seem. But on the whole, I am pleased to continue to work and rework a whole set of characters, not just Spencer and Hawk and Susan, but a kind of surrogate son named Paul Jackman, the various and sundry good guys and bad guys that kick around in there. That's not, when I put them in a book, I don't do so with the intention of recapturing them later and doing it. It's just rather like life. You encounter people, and then next year down the line, there may be a reason to encounter them again, so forth. So I like doing that, and I'll continue to.
I see, physically, I kind of see you as a prototype of Spencer, although perhaps a little shorter. Somehow I see Spencer.
Spencer's taller than I am.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
but
I see him.
Nowhere near as adorable as.
That's true. I was talking to Carol Brenner over at Murder, Inc. Maybe you've been over there to sign some...
I'll be there tomorrow night at 5 o'clock.
And she was telling me a while back that...
That doesn't do any good because this isn't going to be on before that. That plug was entirely wasted.
That's true.
And clip, clip.
That's true. but she was telling me that you were probably her best seller. More people are buying your things there than just about anybody else.
Well, that's good to know.
Top of the list.
Carol has been very active in her efforts to help me along. And I am a lot of people's bestseller because I'm getting to be 14th in the country. A fact which I will keep telling everyone.
Sure.
What's your name? I'm a best-selling author.
Well, listen, there's nothing that succeeds like success. People say, hey, everybody else is reading this.
I've
got to read it.
Yeah, one hopes.
Delacorte came out with just about everything in one lump, huh?
Yeah, I had published with another publisher, both in hard and soft cover, for the first five books, and then I shifted to Delacorte. Delacorte for hardcover, Dell for paper. And the previous publisher, in a fit of pique, allowed the books to go out of print. We, and I don't mean the royal we, agents, lawyers, publishers, took about 3 years to get that all back, and when the rights got reverted, Dell brought out in a reissue uniform format in paper all of the early books so that all of the Spencer saga is available in paper at $2.95.
Yeah, and nice covers, too.
Well, the covers are good covers as marketing devices. I don't know that I'd want one blown up and hung on my wall. That is, as a,
you
as
have
a,
one in the game room.
As an aesthetic object, I think it lacks something, but as a marketing device, the uniformity of the covers reminds people that they're reading one of a series of books. The differences in the color of the covers reminds people that they're not reading the same book, and it looks very effective in a dump, on a rack, on a shelf, when there are eight or nine of them out there with this varied colored uniform design. I think it's very good.
I hope you never do what Agatha Christie's publishers used to do, and that is to reissue Agatha Christie's works under different titles. So you buy it and you start to read it and say, didn't I see this?
Wait a minute.
Read this before, and you had.
A lot of times they will do that with a movie if the movie title has changed. There is my novel Wilderness, The Last I Heard, and writers are not always intimately connected with the movies that are made from their novels, including Wilderness, of which I wrote at least two drafts of the screenplay, and may even still have screen credit, I don't know. But I had heard that they would probably change the title. Well, if they do, and it is called Murder in the Jungle, then I'm sure that the publisher will reissue Wilderness with a new title called Murder in the Jungle.
And that's really dumb. You know, Robert Stone wrote a book that won the National Book Award called Dog Soldiers.
Yeah.
And they made a movie out of it with Nick Nolte, and I think it was called...
Something about rain, wasn't it?
No,
Who Stole the Rain?
Who Shall Steal the Rain, or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember the title.
Yeah.
It's a long, kind of a long, boring title for the movie.
Dog Soldiers would have seemed a better title.
Well, why not? I mean, if one had fit the book... And everybody knew the book. It won, had a lot of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
It won the
That's
award.
Right.
And what was the purpose of changing a book that would have attracted people like me to see the movie? Which it did, because I happen to know that the movie was...
Yes, but unless you did, you would not recognize... I don't know. Seems to me that a lot of things are done in the entertainment business because they can be done. Simply, well, we could do this, let's do it. Yeah. And I've... No real insight into why they will change titles. I know that there's some talk of changing the title of Wilderness because they feel it is misleading. In the novel, the title was both literal and symbolic. That is, the people are literally in the woods, but also symbolically in a kind of emotional and psychological wilderness. And I thought it worked fairly well. There is such a concern that people, that the movie-going audience will misread, that people who would like, for instance, a psychological thriller would be put off by the title Wilderness, which would imply that we were going to get some kind of, second remake of Deliverance or something. So they they do, they fiddle with it. They, because they have the time and the effort and the money available to them, they fiddle with it endlessly. There have been at least 7 drafts of the screenplay.
Rumor has it they're going to call it The Petrified Forest.
Good title.
Yeah, somebody should have had that before. One thing I like about the Spencer books, too, is the setting. The fact that, of course, you live in New England, but having it in Boston. You know, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and even to a degree New York, they become boring after a while. Same settings, and having a different locale for your character is nice. And you make specific references to Boylston Street and all that.
Well, I live there, so I know the city, and when I used to attempt to teach fiction writing, I used to try and urge people to do the oldest piece of advice in the world, write about what you know, and yet endlessly people would set their, people who would live in Jamaica Plain section of Boston would set their novel in Chicago. And I would say, have you been to Chicago? And they'd say, no. I said, why don't you set it in Jamaica Plain? They said, can you do that? I said, yeah, you can do that. So I set it in Boston because I lived there. If I lived in New York, I'd set it in New York. If I lived in Jamaica Plain, I'd set it in Jamaica Plain.
Well, Martin Burke has written a book published by Boston Publishing House, Houghton Mifflin, called The Commissar's Report. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty good book. But he's from Toronto. And for some reason, he set the his novel in New York City. Now, he's visited New York a lot. And it seemed fairly true to it. I mean, he didn't have all the little details that I might have. I live on the West Side. Mm-hmm. But it just, why didn't he put it in Toronto?
I don't know.
You know, that
would
just seem to me a more natural. He's a Canadian. Yeah. Yeah. It would seem to me he would have known the characters, the voice, the style.
If you're going to do, now I have put Spencer in Los Angeles once in a savage place where I have spent a lot of time. And I have put him in various, Judas Goat, he went to a lot of foreign countries and ended up at the 76 Olympics in Montreal. If you are going to do that, you can do that when your hero is an outsider looking at the city. That is, Spencer goes to Los Angeles and is not a native of Los Angeles, not expected to know the nuances of life. I couldn't write a novel about Spencer if he were supposed to be a native of Los Angeles, living in Los Angeles, because I only know it from an outsider's point of view. And I can send him anywhere as long as we agree that he's looking at it from the outside rather than the inside. But to locate him in his home, which is Boston, then he has to see it from the inside, as I do. If I would not ever send him someplace I hadn't been. A couple of times I've wanted to put him in a place that I'd never been to, so I made it up. I made up a place called Redford, Illinois, because I'd never been downriver. I'd been Chicago, but I'd never been down the Mississippi. And I wanted a Mississippi River town, so I made it up. And I got a letter from someone who said I did it just right. They'd been there.
Well, to kind of wrap things up, Robert Parker, because we've been talking a half an hour, and I'm going to have to wade through a lot of tape, although it's certainly fun talking with you. Just tell me a little bit about your work habits after teaching creative writing and knocking out, 14 books?
Something like that,
14?
Yeah.
What kind of workspace do you create for yourself at home?
Well, I have an office. One of the rooms in my house is an office with the normal office accoutrements. And I normally write when I'm not promoting books, 5 pages a day. That is my standard and my goal, and I always meet it, so that each day, sometime during the day, I will write 5 pages a day. The other parts of my day, I have 3 things that basically I wish to do in a day. When the day is going smoothly, I want to run 2 or 3 miles. Run may be a stronger word than I should use. I want to perambulate. Whatever I'm doing up there, I want to do for several miles. I want to work out in the Nautilus machinery over at the health club, and I want to write 5 pages. And it doesn't make too much difference what order I do those in. But if I get those 3 things done in the day, then I have done my day's task, as it were. 5 pages a day takes me a various amount of time, but I would normally expect it would take maybe 4 hours or so.
Do you a lot of revision?
None. Take that, you freshman English teachers out there. Except in Valediction, which I did some fairly extensive revision at the wise behest of my editor. Other than that, for all practical purposes, I have not ever revised anything. What you see is what comes out of my typewriter.
Do you work closely with the editor?
Not usually. Valediction, for reasons which are unrelated to our topic, was a more complicated book for me to write. And it needed some revision. But normally that kind of Tom Wolfe, Maxwell Perkins stuff is long gone. Much of the function of an editor at a major publishing house is acquisition, to get other writers from other publishing houses to come and publish with you. And I do a lot of planning. That is, I write a treatment, and then I write an outline from the treatment. And all of that may take several months. It may take as long to get the thing thought out as it does to write it. But once it's thought out, then the writing 5 pages, that's why I can write 5 pages a day, because I have spent a lot of time thinking about it. It doesn't always take 3 months. Sometimes I can think the thing up in a day and a half, but sometimes it takes a long time. And that's the hard part. I mean, you sort of sweat. You got a pad of paper there, you got a book to write, and you have no idea in your head, you know, and you just sit and think about it, and nothing's happening, you know, and nothing's going on the paper. And that's a drag, you know. And the book I'm working on now, which is called A Catskill Eagle, which has nothing to do either with the Catskills or eagles, it's a line from Moby Dick. This is going to be a 400-page Spencer novel, which will be twice the size of the normal Spencer novel.
It'll be your biggest yet?
Much the biggest. That took me nearly 4 months to think of the essential pattern of the book. And those are hard months. The 5 pages a day are bad. And all you have to do is think about the writing. And in truth, if you can do it, it's not that hard to do. If you can't do it, it's impossible. But
well, my last question to you, Robert Parker, and I think it just may sound like a hokey question, but I think it's in your particular instance, it's a valid one, because you were a professor and you dealt with young people, and you already had dropped a little hint in terms of advice, and it's know your locale. But do you have any advice that you can give to aspiring writers such as myself and even younger people than myself?
Are there people young? Oh, heavenly days. Write it and send it in. That's all advice I can give. That's all there is. The difference between successful published writers and non-successful unpublished writers lies very frequently in the area of will. Will you do it? I'm sure there are people with my talent or greater talent than mine who have yet to publish a novel and who never will, because they spend time talking to each other about it, showing it to their uncle, getting the view of somebody. You know, it's rare when I go someplace that someone doesn't have a manuscript they'd like me to read, and I won't read it. I won't read it, partly because there's no point to me reading it. I'm not going to publish it. And the fact that I like it will not influence a publisher. Publisher's got
to
like it.
Oh, you know, that happens to me, too. People
write
will call me and say, would I read their manuscript, and can I help them find a publisher?
Yeah.
And
publishers want you. Publishers want writers. They don't write themselves. They need writers as bad as writers need publishers. And if you've got something they can sell, they'll publish it.
Yeah, I tell people, I say, what can I do? You know, I do, you know, it's true. I'm the literary guy on CBS Radio, but I don't publish them myself.
That's
and
right.
I don't have time to critique somebody else's book. And so please spare me. But I've given them tips. I mean, people ask me, what would be a good publisher for the kind of thing I'm doing, and I know most of the publishing houses pretty well, and I might be able to steer them to the right publishing house.
Yeah.
Sometimes a university press is better for some of the things people do.
Unless you're interested in profit.
I certainly enjoy talking to you, and I know you have autographs to sign downtown. Walden Books today?
Walden Books today, and Mysterious Book Stop tonight, and things like that.
More interviews, too?
Yeah. I, in detail, I have to whip up my schedule and look.